We are going to continue in looking at the book of Genesis chapter 1. I feel as if we are taking a frantic pace through Genesis 1. I always, you guys know me as a preacher, I like to park on one verse and stay there for a couple of months and then move on to the next one and the next one. And we're purposefully not doing that. As we look at Genesis, our goal is not what I normally do in preaching, which is just to unfold and unpackage the book of Genesis. Now, by the way, we will be doing that. This is not Pastor is riffing on his ideas today. We will be unpacking that, but we're headed somewhere. We're going somewhere. The series that we are looking at right now is to display His glory. That's really our goal for our church, to display the glory of God. And we're focusing as we look at Genesis at stewardship as it was taught from the beginning and beyond. And what I want us to begin to understand is that man, and upon the creation of man, was indelibly imprinted his purpose as a steward. Man was taken and he was created in the image of God, and immediately what happens? God gives him responsibilities and God gives him duties. Genesis chapter 2, I think it is verse 15, says, "And the Lord took the man and put him in the garden to what? To work it and to keep it." God created man with the express purpose of displaying His glory, of manifesting His glory. You see, when we look at the image of God in man, it tells us less about who man is and more about who God is. Now, let me tell you how not to find God in man. Don't look at man and hope that you'll somehow derive who God is. But Genesis, the first parts of this, begins with expressing to us, this is who God is. And last week, we took our time looking at God, the glorious Creator and Redeemer. We ended with this concept of God being the Redeemer, that the beginning, in the beginning, it was pregnant with the end, that the God who created man was prepared in the beginning to redeem man, that God eternal, who transcends time, was doing that. And now we're going to begin to look at the man that He would redeem, or the men that He would redeem. And this morning, we've entitled our message this morning, Reflective Representatives. We are called, we were made in the image of God, which means we reflect God, in the likeness of God, which means we represent God. And we're going to be looking at that this morning as we go through this passage. We're going to, by the way, touch on this passage and go a whole lot of other places as we look at this. But in Genesis chapter 1, we first of all see that man was created by God. Our three points that we're going to be looking at this morning is man was created by God, man was created like God, and man was created for God. So you get those three places, that's where we're going. By God, like God, for God. I'm going to warn you ahead of time, it's going to take me a long time to make it through those first two points. And we're going to briefly touch on the last one, and next week we're going to pick up where we left off and begin to continue to look at the fact that we were created for God. But as we look at this, I want us to begin with how creation started. The Bible tells us that the first 5 days of creation, God is creating the house or the home in which man would live. We're going to go through that. Last week we looked at creation generally. We looked at the fact that you have to hold to a literal creation to literally understand the Bible. And we took a long time looking at numbers of scriptures that teach us a literal creation, and that God, by His Word, spoke, and it came to be. But we didn't spend a whole lot of time on those days, and so we're going to go back and look at the days of creation. In the first 5 days, we see God creating the home, or the house, in which man would live. Day one, God created the light and the material to shape His universe into its final form. Day two, he creates the expanse of the heavens between the waters above and the waters below. Day three, he separates the dry land from the water, and he gathers into the seas and creates trees and plants. On day three, a whole lot begins to take shape. And then in days four through six, we see God populating his creation, right? So we see a parallel relationship inside of creation. On day one, he creates light. On day four, he creates the means by which that light is transmitted, the sun, the moon, and the stars. On day two, he created the water and the sky, which corresponds to day five, in which God creates the animals, the fish that would live in the water, and the birds that would live in the sky. On day three, he creates the land and the plants and the tree and the trees. And on day six, paralleling that, he created man and land animals who would live on those plants and live on the dry ground. So creation, we see, is perfectly balanced. In days one through three, he's creating form. Days four through six, he's creating the fullness. And it just goes to show the structure or the organized nature of our God. Each of these first days are paralleled by the final three. And notice this. Each of those days, regardless of what was made of them, was preceded by this phrase, "And God said." It doesn't "and then there came to be." It really, each one begins with "and God said." Verse 3, verse 6, verse 11, verse 14, verse 20, verse 24, verse 26, verse 29. That's a whole lot of times that God said something. The impetus or the mode of God's creation, the means of God's creation, was his voice. He spoke and it came to be. It doesn't say that there's not here a process that took an additional millions and millions of years. It says, "And God said, and it came to be." Psalm chapter 33, verses 9 through 6 says this, "By the word of the Lord the heavens were made, and the breath of his mouth all their host. He gathers the waters in the sea as the heap. He puts the deeps in the storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke, and it came to be. He commanded, and it stood firm." God spoke, and the world came into existence. And guess what? It stayed that way. The complexity of what God spoke into existence is absolutely staggering. Now, I have told you, I am not a scientist. And so when I tell you scientific stuff, it means I read it from someone. This did not come out of my ideas or my mind. But I do think that we have a beautiful concept in the Scriptures that tell us the heavens declare the glory of God. Think about the complexity of the night sky. You look into the sky, and when you're out at the Moffitt's, you see a little bit better. But what do you see? You see the stars. And you know what? Those stars look like they're fixed in space. Like they're not moving. They seem as if they're staying. From the Earth's vantage point, they are moving, but so relatively slowly that they appear to be in the same place. Their movements are so consistent that we can actually chart our course by them. Do you see what's happening here? The sun is dragging our entire solar system from one end of the universe to the other end of the universe. The Milky Way galaxy is in orbit, and scientists calculate that it would take 225 million years to complete that orbit. And everything else in its orbit corresponds to that. It is doing exactly what God designed it to do. And guess what? He created all of that with a simple word. "Let there be," and so, and it was so. Everything. The creation of day two was filled on day five with the birds and the fish. They were different than the plants that were created on the birds and fish were different than the plants that were created on day three. They are creatures They move. Do you know the difference between a creature and a plant? A plant doesn't move of its own volition. Now, you could train a plant by sunflowers. Their little flower points at the sun, and so you can make its head go a certain direction. So in that way, it moves. But it doesn't respond really at all to the things that are going on it. God, on this day, day two, filled it with creatures that were alive. By the way, this is the opposite order in which evolutionists present this. Evolutionists present that out of the water crawled all of life, and yet we see on day three the plants and the plants are made, and then we see that the oceans are filled. So it's a different order than evolution would suggest. The creation of day three was filled on day six with animals that produced after their kind. Notice it says that after their kind. Plants, fish, birds, and animals all produce after their kind. This indicates a limitation of variations. Every living thing did not come out of some cosmic event or cosmic ooze. God created them to reproduce after their kind, not to mutate and to evolve. One piece of creation does not evolve into another. God created these creatures the way that they are. Dolphins are dolphins. Turtles, I know this is really simple. Turtles are turtles. Ants are ants. Though there's many different kinds, ants are ants. Spiders are spiders. Snakes are snakes. Frogs are frogs. Dogs have always been dogs. Horses are horses. God here says he created them and then they reproduced after their kind. The creation of day six, however, was split into two movements, I guess would be a way to be able to say that. And it seems as if the first part of the day, God creates all of the animals. So he creates all of the livestock, the creeping things, so that's anything with short legs that belly crawls next to the ground, and then also the beast. Those are probably talking about really giant beasts, or, you know, like elephants. I like elephants. The creation was split into 2 days. In verse 24, which we had read for you, it says, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures according to their kind, livestock, creeping things, and beasts of the earth according to their kind." And then notice verse 25 restates that and it says, "And God made the beasts of the earth according to their kinds and the livestock according to their kinds, everything that creeps on the ground according to its kind." Notice they're not following an evolutionary process. In fact, the processes are switched up. In the first verse, it says, he created them livestock, creeping things, and beasts. And in verse 25, it says beasts, livestock, and creeping things, and then again in chapter 2, when we see that again, it's in a different order. We're not looking at a progression of one species to another species, but we're looking at an instantaneous creation. When God spoke, all of these things instantly came to being, and this was the final touch on God's creation before he made man. The second part of day six is really where we're going to park today, is God creates the main character, God creates man, or God creates humans. If you like alliterated outlines, there's my illiterate outline, home, human. And so we're now looking at humans, and humans are the apex of all of creation. All of creation led up to this point, the creation of man. God had prepared the house in which man would live, but man was the object of this. Man was the main issue. Man was the pinnacle of God's creation, and man was the only piece of God's creation that was created in his image. Do you realize that man is the only permanent part of God's creation? The book of Revelation tells us that everything else in the universe will one day perish. The stars will fall, the sun will go out, the moon will come to an end, the universe will roll up like a scroll, the creation will melt with a fervent heat, it will dissolve, everything that was created will be uncreated except man. The main character in the theater of creation upon which the great redemptive story would be played out is man. Everything that lives on this earth, every green thing, every plant, every tree, every occupant, everything in the sea, everything in the sky, everything that you will ever see in the universe will die. But not man. Man is the main character placed in the theater of God's creation. And it is in that theater that God plans the great redemptive narrative in which God, the triune God, would seek a bride out of redeemed humanity for his son. The universe of angels as well as man will watch as God manifests his glory by demonstrating his grace and mercy and saving power. This distinction between man and creation is very clear in the passage that we are currently looking at. And it's seen by a number of contrasts in the passage. Let me point out the first one we want to look at here. Look at verse 24 here. And God said, "Let the earth bring forth." And then compare that to verse 26. "Then God said, let us make man." You see, there's a difference there. All of creation, every day begins, "Let there be, let there be, let there be." When it comes to man, God introduces himself personally to his personal creation. "Let us make man." This speaks of a conversation that someday maybe we can go and get insight into, but it says, "Let us make man." We looked at the Trinity last week and we spent time in that. We could spend a whole lot more time. If you're wondering what we said last week, that message is online. You can go look at what we looked at with the Trinity. But this speaks of a conversation in which God had been talking about redemption. He had been talking about man. The plan unfolded in the mind of God. The Creator made a plan of redemption, and this was his plan. God perfectly loved the Son and wanted to demonstrate his love to the Son. He would get a bride for his Son, created in his image, that would worship, love, and obey him and spend all eternity with him. And literally, he would bring that redeemed humanity up to where the Trinity lives in the glories of heaven, and they would live there forever. That was God's plan. God put a personal touch on man. He says here, "Let us make man." This goes, however, just beyond his formation, and it begins to be spoken about also in the very structure of who man is. "Let us make man." And then it says, "in his image, according to his likeness." Now, when God made all of the other creation, plants and animals, notice he says, and verse 24, and by the way, I'm using verses 24 and 5 because they're mirrored by the others, but it says, "Bring forth living creatures according to their," what? "According to their kinds." When God makes man, he does not say, "Let us make man according to their kind." He says something different. It says, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness." When man is created, God uses the terms image and likeness. When animals, when everything else is created, he uses the term kind. We're going to spend a lot of time on that piece, so mark that in your head. We're coming back to it. But there's another piece that I want us to be able to see that's another contrast in this passage. After God creates man, he speaks to them in a way that he does not speak to any of his other creation. Notice verse 28. "And God blessed them, and God said to them." Now, at day 5, when God creates the fish and the birds, he also speaks to them. It says, "And God said," let me look at that in verse 22, "And God blessed them, saying," But notice here there's a difference in this, in the way that that works in verse 28. And God blessed them and said to them. We see a personal speaking to man. And in this we see a different message than to the others. The others were called to be fruitful and multiply. But man is given a responsibility that no other piece of creation is given. They are given what we have called the dominion mandate. They are called to have dominion over everything else in that. God speaks here to man. He blesses them. And he uses here distinctly personal language over and over. He says, and he said to them, or and he blessed them, and he said to them. This blessing is what we often call the dominion mandate. Man was made in the image of God, and he was given a special opportunity to display the glory of God as no other piece of creation could. Man is different than the rest of his creation. And what I want you to understand is everything in creation was formed and fitted just right for man. He created the whole universe and everything that was merely to stage the plan, or merely as a stage for which the plan, on which the plan would unfold. So, I look at that and then I ask, was it necessary to do all of that? I mean, really, was it necessary to do all of this creative work just for man? Couldn't he have just said, let's have man? Yes. Do you know why? Creation is first and foremost a manifestation of who God is. And God manifested himself, not in a salvific way, but in a general way. All of creation does speak specifically about its creator. It's not general information. It's specifically, it points to God. Now we know it's not enough to save, but it is enough that each man looks at creation and is responsible to look to God. But God did that for the purpose of revealing himself to man. How do we know that? The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament show his handiwork. As we stand in at night and look into the sky and see all of the celestial beings, all of the celestial pieces up there, do you know what it says? Somebody hung each of those stars. Somebody placed each of those there as we feel the light of the sun upon our bodies. And it's not scalding us and we're not freezing. It reminds us that God did that for his glory. As we look at the mountains, which in Colorado, we're a little bit closer to God, not just because of elevation, but we have the privilege of every single morning looking out and displaying the magnitude of his power. All of this was to reveal who God is. You see his creation, you see his power and his might in the mountains, you see his intelligence and wisdom in the stars and their path, you see his love and his beauty throughout creation. You can see his power and hear his power in the crashes of thunder, in the flashes of lightning. You can see his gentleness as you look at a flower and the intricacies of that little, of those petals. His order is clear as the stars and planets and these massive bodies careen through space in their orbits without colliding. Everything was made perfectly just for a habitation of man. Let me tell you what didn't happen. God didn't take the box of Legos and shake it until it shook out right. You try that. It's not going to work. God created this earth specifically for man so that man could look and see his glory. His creation is a manifestation of himself. Bob Kellerman and Sam Williams write in a book entitled Christ-Centered Biblical Counseling, the name of our earthly home, Eden, carries in the original Hebrew text the connotation of a pleasant place of delight. Even the trees and food are designed in such a way that they are pleasant to the sight and good for food. Like a good father designs a home for the children whom he loves, God pays special attention not only to how he made us, but also the place in which he has given us to reside. Scientists have recognized this remarkable congruence between people and the earthly home in which they dwell, sometimes called the anthropomorphic. That's not the right word. Anthropic. You start reading big words and you just make them bigger. Anthropic principle. It is plain for all to see that every aspect of this planet, from its atmosphere to the motion of the sun and the moon, to the geology and to the weather, to the composition of plants and animals, it is fine-tuned just right to support human life. God made man a garden in which he was given the responsibility to work for the express purpose of giving glory to God. I want us to see something that as I read this week, I had never really thought, but do you realize God still does this special formation in every single human being? We begin with Psalm 139, verse 13 says, "You formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. I give thanks to you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works, and my soul knows well." This special formation of man can be seen beyond Genesis in the conception, pregnancy, and birth. Every baby is formed in the womb. So we first have seen that everything was created by God, and man was given an esteemed position as the pinnacle of his creative work. And if we stop there, we have stopped short of what the Bible is telling us. Because there are some implications that I believe are essential for us to understand. First of this, you and every human being does not exist as a result of random cosmic events. Our formation was not impersonal. You were designed by an intelligent, holy, powerful, loving God. The honor and dignity with which we were created calls us to treat every person, regardless of their race, regardless of their riches, regardless of their age. This applies to babies and old people too. Regards us to understand each of them as created in the image of God. Our plot line is far from the evolutionary one. Evolution tells us this: the chief end of man is mere existence and genetic population. Wow, that reduces me to kind of nothing, doesn't it? And you wonder why people are hurtling through this world, gazing for a purpose. It's because they are told you came out of the animals, you are simply a highly evolved animal, and all you gotta do is survive, and there is no purpose in that. Man was created not just to survive, but to live, to display the glory of God. I can get a little bit passionate about that. You see, the chief end of man is to glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. We were created with the express purpose to love, worship, and glorify God. Imprinted upon our very hearts is a Godward focus. We were created in the image of God. Let me ask you something. If you begin with something other than God, what will you discover about man? You'll find the wrong conclusions. Man began to look into evolution to remove themselves from a personal responsibility to a creator God. But do you realize when we look at man created by God, we are given a responsibility? Now there's, by the way, a number of other applications or implications, but if we stay there, we won't get into the meat of what we're looking at. Man was also created like God. By our creation, we reflect and represent God. Notice there in the passage it says, in the image and likeness of God. Now, These are pretty much synonymous terms. They mean the same thing. But it does help me to kind of look at this as we were created in the image of God. We reflect Him. And the likeness of Him, we represent Him. Let me give you an example of this that may help you to be able to understand this. Over here in the corner, we have a piece of cloth that is hanging off of a post. Do you see that piece of cloth over there? What do we call that piece of cloth? A flag. And there are numbers of people that are unhappy with our current political climate right now that are taking that piece of cloth and burning it. Why is it they choose that cloth instead of going to Joann Fabrics, buying a cheaper bolt of fabric and burn it on the side of the road? Why do they choose that? It stands for something. It points to something. And most of us would be very offended when a person takes the flag, which is not a mere piece of cloth anymore. It has a significance that is attached to it. You realize that to disrespect a person made in the image and likeness of God is a whole lot worse than desecrating a flag. We should be offended and repulsed by that in the same way when God's image bearers are desecrated, abused, beaten, and neglected, discriminated against, and not loved and taken care of as they ought to be, because every man bears the image of God. Now, we haven't gotten to the fall yet. When we get to the fall, we're going to see that that image of God was distorted, it was twisted, but it was not extracted or removed. Theologians call this concept the imago Dei. This is what separates man from the animals. This is a basis of a radical equality in worth and value among all people. Now, when you think survival of the fittest, do you know what that does? It immediately gives you the fittest, right? So you've got these people who they're going to survive because they're the fittest, and then there are others. It begins to divide up man into a natural. These are the best of the people, and these are they could probably, not continue. But do you realize the creation of man gives us no such way to be able to categorize a man with a different color of skin or a different ethnic status or a different value or wealth or a different purpose as more important than another? Wow, tell that to your pride. Every single day we're in traffic. Someone cuts us off, and why are we mad? Because they cut me off. You realize that God, in His creation of man, created us each to equally represent and to reflect Him. The idea of this imago Dei has long been debated. In fact, no scripture passage says this is the image of God and it is this, 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 and this. In fact, if we are going to study the image of God in man, it is important for us to start at looking at who God is. The problem with many ideas and manifestations of who man is today is they start with the creation and they eliminate the Creator. That's why last week we began by looking at God, the Creator and Redeemer. And now we're going to look at man. Some hold that man is structured like God. Some hold that as man we have relationships like God. Others hold that we function like God. And there are people who are going to debate that we're one more than the others. And I just say, probably all three. As we look at this, emphasizing one of these tends to exclude the others. And all of these are true. So this morning, we're going to look at three pieces of the image of God. We're going to look at who we are, the relationships that we have, and then what we do. So first of all, who we are. We are rational beings. Human beings are unlike any other of the creatures because they are able to engage in complex reasoning. Now, we have a dog that we have trained fairly well. In fact, as we have trained the dog, we have enjoyed training her with a number of different commands. One of the first commands that we taught her was get in the bathtub. It was very hard for our dog to want to take a bath, and so we would say, Roxy, get in the bathtub. There was a problem. We moved. And when we moved, she couldn't recognize a bathtub. Because for her, it was a certain location in our house. It wasn't the what we would call a bathtub. Now, I have a four-year-old daughter. But if I came over to your house and I told her, go get in the bathtub, do you know what she would do? She would find your bathroom and she would get in the bathtub. I take my dog over and I say, go get in the bathtub. And you know what she's going to do? She's going to find the nearest source of food and eat it all. You see, there's a difference in our ability to reason. Now, can I train my dog to do something like that? Yes. But it is simply a repetition. Man is given the ability from God to reason in a complex manner. Paul Tripp writes this, Adam and Eve were created to be revelation receivers. They were created with the ability to hear, understand, and apply God's words to their lives. These abilities were given so that we could know God and understand Him. So we are rational, means that we are innately interpreters. I read a story last week about a little boy who fell down and hurt himself. And all the other little boys came around as his dad was coming up. And he says, don't worry, it's all right, my dad is a doctor. And the dad who was coming up thought to himself, well, that is a problem because I have a religious degree and have no idea how to be able to help this. Yes, he's a doctor, but not that kind of a doctor. You see, he had made an interpretation. My dad's a doctor. The doctors he had seen worked on his body. That must be what my father is. Now, we could come to wrong conclusions with that, but isn't that what we are as people? We are interpreters of what is around us. You realize the rest of creation doesn't do that. Man was created rational in that way, in which he is a revelation receiver. He is created to interpret. And in fact, man has the ability to imagine something far out into the future. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 says, he has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart. Man, in that, is an immortal being. He's spiritual. But also, as we look at who we are, we see that not only are we rational, but we are moral. Every person living or who has ever lived has the same sense of basic right and wrong. Romans chapter 2 says this, I believe, most clearly. It says, for all who have sinned without the law will also perish without the law, and all who have sinned under the law will be judged by the law. For it is not the hearers of the law who are righteous before God, but the doers of the law who will be justified. For when Gentiles who do not have the law by nature do what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the work of the law is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or even excuse them. On that day, according to my gospel, God judges the secret of men by Christ Jesus. This also reminds us that all of men, because God has written His law upon our hearts, given us a moral conscience, are therefore morally accountable to God. There is a remarkable overlap in the moral code throughout human history. Lying, stealing, sexual immorality, just to name a few, are generally things that across all of human kind is something that is wrong. This applies to everybody but pirates, right? That's what C.S. Lewis says in his book, Mere Christianity. He says, now one would say that pirates do not believe in a moral code because they make their living by breaking all of these things. And that is true until you lie, steal, or take from a pirate. And then he has a very intense feeling that that was wrong. See, we were created with a moral compass that God makes us with. So that tells us about who we are. We are rational. We are moral. The next thing that we look at is the relationships that we have. These relationships are most clearly given when Jesus gives the top two commandments. Love God and what? Love one another. Love your neighbor. These commands for relationship were not given to anything else in the created world. We reflect God in the relationships that we have. As human beings, we display God's image most when we know and love God. That is the process of sanctification, isn't it? It is growing to become more like Christ, whose image perfectly reflected the image of God in man. No animal or tree can do this. Perhaps rabbits know that God exists. I mean, in fact, I really am not sure about that. But even if they do, have rabbits ever built a cathedral or written a hymn? When human beings relate to God, they're doing something that only God's image bearers do. And when we relate to God, we relate to Him through the medium of worship. This is essential for us to understand. This is that there are so many theories of human motivation that would say we relate to God based upon our needs, we relate to God based upon all sorts of things. But I want to tell you that God, that the Bible clearly and explicitly states that we relate to God for the purpose of displaying His glory and living in worship to Him. We also have a relationship with others. Human beings image God by knowing and loving other people. I'm going to talk about Roxy again. Our dog Roxy had a, and I have to do this because that's how I see a beast, you know. Our dog Roxy, when she was a puppy, we had some neighbors that also had a puppy. They were very different. Roxy is an Australian Shepherd, and this was a boxer. But they were the best of friends. I mean, when they would come over, Roxy would get excited. They would come in our house, and they both would hide under their bed, and we couldn't get them out. And they would destroy things together. Bertie, which was the boxer, would love to go and turn on the faucet. And so he'd turn on the faucet outside and then would chew up every hose that we owned. And they loved it. I mean, by the time we would come home after they had done that, they were both soaking wet, rolling in mud, and they loved each other. But do you know what? When we moved, Roxy never wrote Bodie a love letter. You know, on her anniversary, well, the day that they met, she didn't look around really mopey. In fact, 2 years later, we had Bodie over to our house with Bodie's parents, and you know what? They didn't like each other anymore. Bodie had become a big boxer. And Bodie was more inclined to kill Roxy than he was to protect Roxy as he had been. But imagine a relationship like that you've had. You remember people from your childhood that were special to you, that were nice to you. You know what? You remember those things. We were created with an opportunity for relationship that helps us to, that uniquely expresses the Trinity, that uniquely expresses that God is in relationship. We were created for a relationship with God and for a relationship with others. Think about this. By the way, our primary goal is not that we need people. Our primary goal is that it is among people that we are able to most reflect God. Do you see that? I mean, think about the Great Commission without other people. Go, therefore, and what? I mean, we're stuck. We could go, but we can't do the essence of it, which is disciple. Think about the command to be fruitful and multiply. You can't do that by yourself. I mean, really, we are looking at the fact that God created us for a relationship in which together we display the image of God. This comes down to what we do. And I know you're thinking, wow, Pastor, you really were right. Your good last point's going to be really short. It will, promise. What we do, this is most clearly seen in the fact that man was given dominion over creation. This is, by the way, the most probably textually obvious of these ways that we are created in the image of God. Because right after it says, let us make man in our image and after our likeness, it says, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea. Heath Lambert, in writing on this, writes, human beings demonstrate the element of an image of God whenever we exercise stewardship in the world. When we build a skyscraper, feed our dog, cut the neighbor's grass, pave a road, adopt a highway, we are caring for the creation in a way that is reminiscent of God's care for the world. And with the other categories, our care for this world is greatly diminished from God's unmatched power and unfading goodness that is the supreme caretaker of the universe. Still, we legitimately image God when we steward the areas of responsibility that He has given to us. Man was created in the image of God for an express purpose. This is essential. You have to understand this. Our world does not teach this. Our world teaches that man was evolved or came to being for the express purpose of gratifying himself and existing. Isn't that what our children are taught in public schools so often? They're taught, just be happy with who you are. You don't, your character, we'd like to see it change, but you're good just the way you are. But do you realize God puts in us a stamp of what we are called to do and give glory to God? Which brings us to our last point that we are going to look at in great depth next week, I promise. But I want us to understand that in creating man, He displays us, or He created us, for God. All right, so if you just look at these first two, by God and like God, we end up with a pretty inflated view of man. God made the world, so what? So it could be my place for a party. You know, so I can have all of this stuff. That's why God made the world. And then God made me like Him. Which, if I start thinking about that, somehow I become God in my imagination. But do you realize He didn't just make, I wasn't just made by God and like God, but I was made with an express purpose. I was made for God. And in this, we're going to look at two pieces that really begin to tie into what our goal in this is. We were created as workers, and we were created as worshipers. Genesis 2:15 says, "The Lord God took the man and put him in the garden to work it and keep it." Now, when you think of gardening, what's the first thing you think of? Weeding. Did that happen to Adam when he first started working the garden? No, because weeds were part of the fall. So what did he do? I mean, it seems like, what do you do? But he was called to do work. Do you realize that when man went into his creation and obeyed, he greater displayed God's glory? The purpose of man was not to work the creation so that it could become something that it wasn't without God. The purpose of man was to do the will of God, and in doing that, he displayed the glory of God. All right, trees, plants, what do they bear? You don't have man, and you got a bunch of animals eating this, but you have man, and you have them harvested. You see, in work, in this, man was created with the purpose of stewarding a display of God's glory. I mean, just think about Eden. Think about everything perfect without any of the problems that we currently have in our world today caused by the fall. How do you improve that? But man, before the fall, get that, before the fall, was created as a steward of God's creation. He was created to work it. That doesn't mean we all now become tree huggers and save the earth. We ought to steward what God has given to us. But we were created and imprinted upon our very nature of who we are. We were created as stewards. Man went into the garden in which he created nothing. He made no fruit bear forward from these things. He did nothing. He simply harvested. He did the work that God had called him to do. And today, somehow, we think it's different. We go to our job and we work and we earn finances, we earn money, and we work hard to be able to do so. And we suddenly say, look at what I have made of myself. Look at how I can enjoy these comforts upon myself. That is not the way that you were created. You were created to recognize that God is the source of everything. And to use everything for His glory. So not only were we created workers, but we were also created worshipers. And by the way, I'm going to come back to that. If your brain is going, what are you doing, Pastor? I'm coming back. But we were also created as worshipers. Piper, in writing on this, writes, people are not important because they breathe. They are important because they have the capacity to honor God with their hearts and minds and bodies long after they stop breathing forever. The most important thing about people is that, unlike animals, trees, they live forever in heaven, glorifying God, or in hell, defying God. The purpose of man is to display God's glory. Worship is more than something that we do. It actually defines who we are as human beings. Say, Pastor, why didn't you start with that? Because I want you to see that this is not just a pastor's idea who says, worship, 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 because that's what pastors should do. My job is in the church, right? This is imprinted upon the very nature of who you are. In fact, you are worshiping something right now. It might be the lunch that you say pastor is preaching into. It might be, you know, something else. But do you realize everything that we do is an act of worship? Everything. We are serving something. We love something. We give ourselves to something. That is, in our nature, what we are. It is what we were created to do. We were created in the image of God, to display the image of God. And in our worship, we either do a good job of that, being conformed to the image of Jesus Christ, or we do a bad job of that, being conformed to the image of that which we worship. This is what we're going to dive into deeply next week. Adam and Eve were created to live so that everything in their lives drew its meaning and purpose from the person, presence, and purpose of God. This is called a Godward referent. Because of this design, everything a human being does expresses worship. What you do, the way you do it, expresses your desire to serve something. Some central love commands our allegiances and directs our behavior. We were created to steward. We were created as workers, and we were created as worshipers. How do you steward the things that God has given to you? Does it show that I was created by God? Does it show that you were created in the image of God? Are you worshiping Him, living for Him? You understand all of life flows out of this. I know we're starting with some deep theological principles. We're going to work our way through the process of this to getting to where the rubber meets the road. But I want you to understand before we get to any of that, you were created for the express purpose of worshiping God. How do you worship God in your finances? How do you worship God in your marriage? How do you demonstrate that He is the one who has created all things? How do you demonstrate His glory? Does your life live as worship to the one true God? Let's close in a word of prayer. Father, we want to thank You for the opportunity to look into Your Word today. Lord, we pray that You would help each of us to understand, Lord, this theological basis of being created by God, like God, and for God. Lord, may we